This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.
We just found out that we're one of four teams in the country that has a shot of getting one of these two expansion teams. That's awesome. And if we don't have a plan, we don't have a chance. And that is the decision.
Cincinnati Mayor John Cranley, the city and county have approved $52 million for infrastructure improvements for a new FC Cincinnati stadium. What's next? And joining us to discuss the FC Cincinnati Stadium plan and what happens next are Cincinnati Inquirer investigative reporter Sharon Coolidge, Inquirer Xavier Basketball and FC Cincinnati reporter Patrick Brennan, Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterick, and WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman. You can join us 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And before we talk about the FC Cincinnati Stadium plan, Sharon, there's been an investigation that's been going on into UC Police Chief Anthony Carter, and they've come to a conclusion, I take it, and that was released today?
You know, that did happen today. Over the Thanksgiving break, we started hearing news that the University of Cincinnati Police Chief had resigned and was being moved into a researcher position, which, you know, as reporters, kind of struck us as odd. We made some public records requests, and we got a response from the university hasn't been talking, and they're still not talking. In fact, they will answer no questions. But they did release an investigation into the matter today, and it was very revealing about what happened. It turns out the university was doing a very significant investigation into some things that happened between three professors. It involves one threatening to kill another one, very serious matters, and two of them are married. And, you know, the report says that the police chief was not investigating that. And again, we're talking about Anthony Carter, the UC police chief, because that can be confusing sometimes. And he inserted himself into the investigation and improperly asked the woman out, really just, you know, 171 texts to her. And with these three times of asking her out and a lot of improper things, you know, there's like, I think, six findings. He didn't document any of this. This came to light some other way. And so we're working on that right now. We got the information just a couple hours ago.
Mm-hmm. So this is just unfolding as we speak then.
It is. But he has been moved into another role at the university. And, you know, the investigation was done by this outside organization, Exeter, that did the whole reforms at the university after everything that happened with Officer Tenzing. And they stopped short of actually making a recommendation about what should happen to him, which seems odd with this huge investigation and a lot of findings. And then they just left everything up to the university. And, of course, we're not getting answers there, so we don't know what went into the decision-making process there.
And we should say that Anthony Carter was, I believe, one of six finalists to be the police chief in the city of Fairfield. And we have reached out to Fairfield, although when I walked in the studio, we hadn't gotten a response yet to see how that was going to affect his status as being a finalist for the police chief job in that city.
But at this point, this is still unfolding. There's a lot we just don't know at this point.
Yeah, you know what? I'm going to read one line from the report. It's a 19-page report. In sum, we find that while Carter may have been concerned about the overall well-being of wife, there's no names in this report, by the way, he engaged in an inappropriate conduct, which was motivated, at least in part, by a desire to further his own personal interests rather than by a legitimate concern for the safety and security of the wife, other faculty, or students, as called for in his role as chief of police.
Okay, so Anthony Carter resigned November 23rd. Correct?
Yes.
Okay. Who's stepped in his place since then?
You know, we don't have a lot of answers on that yet.
The acting police chief is Maris Harold, I believe. She used to be a former Cincinnati police officer. She was the assistant chief and now is the acting chief until they name a permanent successor.
You know, a really highly regarded police officer with Cincinnati Police. Did a lot of problem solving with all of the collaborative things that were when the changes were happening with the Cincinnati Police Department.
Okay, so we'll keep tuned on that one then.
Yes, more
to,
definitely.
Definitely more to come. Okay, on the stadium plan, City Council votes this week. They approve an infrastructure plan. What was in that plan, Chris? What exactly?
Good question.
does anybody know?
Well, there is the city side of this. There were two votes, one in the county, one in the city. There was the city side could be up to $37 million for infrastructure. What we're talking about there is roads, sewers, electric, gas lines, you know, and extending roads around the site, not just widening the roads leading up to it. So there's $37 million in there from several sources. One major source being a rainy day fund that had a little bit over $7 million bucks in it. Another source being the city's share of the excess lodging tax revenue. And then another source being tax increment financing districts. Those are basically plots of land where the property taxes go back into the site rather than being distributed to local governments. So those were all of the things in there. We don't know exactly yet how much, you know, we don't have a breakdown of the costs yet for each of those items, the roads, the sewers, et cetera. So that's all been a little bit opaque, I think, for people's, you know, at least in my case, a little bit opaque in terms of what we would like to see in terms of details. So that's mainly the source. And then the county had $15 million that they're going to contribute approximately for a parking garage that'll have about 1,000 spaces.
Now, I think the team had asked for 2,000, hadn't they? For 2,000 parking spaces?
Originally, they'd asked for, I mean, they thought they were going to need 4,000 at one point. So this garage has been busted down to size. And I think that they hope to arrange, you know, contracts with other parking areas across Oakley Station where this is going to go, maybe going to go. And they'll fill in the gap that way. But it's still the thing about this whole thing is that it leaves a gap in funding for the whole infrastructure at the site. The city estimated that they had a wide estimate of anywhere from $12 million to $85 million, which is a huge.
It's just a few million dollars.
Yeah, you know, yeah. Right. And keep in mind that also may include other plots of land around this site that aren't directly on the site. So FC had asked for a minimum of $70 million. And so if you just take, you know, $52 million to $70 million, they're about $20
million short. So Pat wrote about the original, like, what's the team doing? Like, the numbers are so huge. We're talking about one part of it. Tell us, what's the numbers again?
The private money that they're putting down, you mean? So admittance to the league, if FC Cincinnati is selected later this month to be one of two expansion teams, would cost them $150 million. The ownership group, which is headed by Carl Leonard III, they're putting that money up. They are also putting down $200 million to build the stadium itself. So a total investment of $350 million.
And this originally was going to be a 25,000-seat stadium, wasn't it, Pat?
It was. It was pared down to size because of, I think fair to say, a lack of governmental support from the entities that Chris was just talking about.
Yeah. Now, when will we know for sure whether Cincinnati is in MLS or not? What's the date for that?
So there's a couple important dates to keep in mind here. Now that they have been named a finalist and now that they have the stadium situation put to bed enough for now, they'll go up to New York City next week. And on the 6th, they will make a final presentation to Major League Soccer and the expansion committee. That will bookend, essentially, the expansion process. On the 14th, the MLS Board of Governors will vote. They're scheduled to vote on these four expansion finalists, the other three being Detroit, Nashville, and Sacramento. And the calendar, there's a general window. A lot of this has, the dates have fluctuated along the way, but the calendar window where I'm expecting to hear a final answer on FC Cincinnati's expansion bid is between the 18th and the 20th.
But suffice it to say, this month is going to be a big month for that decision.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Is this the that's the one that I'm still stuck on in mind? You basically $150 million to be involved in this process.
Mm-hmm.
Is that common, like with NFL expansion, major? I mean, it hasn't happened obviously recently, but new baseball teams. It seems like that's it's almost like you had to pay $150 million pay to play.
Yeah, and I think they're one of the higher fees in pro sports, aren't they, Patrick?
You know, it's a great question. I'm not really well versed on expansion fees for other leagues because this isn't something you see
right.
very often. I mean, MLS is expanding in waves. You know, MLB, Major League Baseball, they might expand one team at a time here and there in a market that has a need to fill. But MLS is bringing on teams, you know, at least once annually for the last few years, and now it'll be two and then four eventually coming up by 2022.
The MLS fee has gone up recently, but in terms of comparing it to the NFL and the MLB, you know, like Patrick said, there haven't been a lot of expansions, but the teams that recently moved, for example, from San Diego to Los Angeles in the NFL and St. Louis to Los Angeles, they paid fees in well in excess of $150 million just to move their franchises. So I would expect if the NFL ever did expand again, I think the fee would far exceed what MLS requires you to pay.
Yeah, that's fair to say.
And it's important to note, I mean, it's interesting, the team has viewed this, they will say, we made a $350 million investment. Keep in mind, the 150 of the 350 is to other billionaires, basically.
Yeah.
So how realistic is this, Patrick? I mean, they're competing with three other cities. Why would MLS pick Cincinnati? Is that a pretty... Go ahead.
I think there's a very good chance they pick Cincinnati. Of the four finalists, only two, Cincinnati and Sacramento, have an existing team. Nashville is set to kick a ball for the first time this spring. And Detroit, it's kind of the first time they kick a ball would be in 2020 if they were to even get into MLS. So those two markets are largely projections. The thing I like about Cincinnati's bid, and a lot of this extends to Sacramento as well, is that they're not a projection, to borrow phraseology from Jeff Birding. All the metrics point in the right direction with Cincinnati. The TV numbers are good. The attendance numbers are off the charts, quite frankly. Merchandise sales through the roof. So, and the relevance in this market, just all those things point to that. And the fan base is still growing. They have not... There's no indication they've hit their ceiling for how big this movement, as the club has called it. There's no indication they're anywhere near the ceiling for or tapped out as far as what this could be. So, you know, I think there is a very good chance that Cincinnati could end up being one of these two teams that gets selected.
Patrick, is it true that that Detroit doesn't have a soccer-specific stadium plan like Cincinnati, that their idea was to use Ford Field?
Right. That's correct. So do you want me to?
Go ahead.
Yeah. So that's an interesting question I've been asked a couple times this week because obviously very recently MLS told elected officials and FC Cincinnati themselves that Paul Brown Stadium was not a viable option. I have a couple theories about why Detroit was then made a finalist with Ford Field, an NFL venue, as its final venue or as its final stadium proposal for MLS. I think that might have been a courtesy based on who is in that ownership group. Some very prominent people. Obviously, the Ford family is a part of it now. Dan Gilbert, the owner of the Cleveland Cavaliers. And I think this would install them effectively as a front runner, not to be messed with for the next round of expansion. And then there are people that reasonably say, well, there are a few outliers with the MLS stadium situation. There's a few teams playing in MLS venues, but they have numbers and market size to back that up, to justify, like in Atlanta and Seattle. There's a proven track record there of being able to fill an NFL-sized stadium. Again, Detroit is still very much a projection in that respect. So it's tough to say if an NFL-sized venue, even one with reduced capacity for soccer games, will suffice for MLS for this round of expansion.
I was going to ask that. Do you think they will continue? So let's assume that, you know, Detroit is not selected and moves on to the mm-hmm. next, you know, round. Will they still be a front runner if they don't comply with the soccer-specific stadium requirement, at least as it's alleged by the MLS?
Right. Yeah. I don't think they would. I think the spirit of what MLS has said all along is that the soccer-specific stadium, and I think one of the things that was reasonably frustrating for FC Cincinnati fans who are really keyed in on this subject is that as it pertained to the conversation here, whenever Todd Portune would talk about Paul Brown Stadium, well, you know, a lot of people knew what the outcome was going to be there before Todd Portune finally got the answer he needed from the people he wanted it from. So, but yeah, the spirit of the conversation all along has been soccer specific is the only way to go. MLS is trying to achieve a certain aesthetic there. And I think there's also some scar tissue from a time when the league was largely the teams were renting space in NFL venues and the aesthetic looked terrible because you had 10, even 20,000 fans in a massive, massive arena that wasn't full.
So the bid, there's so much criteria, right? These bid packages aren't like, can you build a stadium? That's just, it's not the only thing. But in Cincinnati, where we've been, you know, we have so much consternation about our stadiums and what we've spent on them. A lot of it has come down to the stadium. It's been the focus of the bid. And, you know, I think some leaders are very frustrated because they want the focus to be, we're bringing a major league team to Cincinnati. Soccer's so exciting. But the conversation has veered to this one specific part of the bid, which is the stadium, in which where we had all of these votes this week.
I think a lot of people are thinking back to that, the vote on the Bengals Red Stadium tax back in the 90s.
Right, and so that, I mean, that's caused a lot, that's a lot of public comment. And this is where, when it comes to asking for the infrastructure, the $70-75 million, we had to have two votes this week, and they're political votes from city council and from the commissioners. And it's like, well, what were they going to do? And so we've just, and then this, so this week we've very much narrowed in on what was going to happen. Could we have a soccer-specific stadium? And it was really in flux up until Monday when we saw what city council was going to vote.
What happens if they're not accepted into the MLS? Does this whole deal just go away?
Some of it goes away. So, you know, they didn't really pass legislation. They passed basically a resolution, basically a promise that in the future we'll work out a deal and build this parking garage for you. But the expiration on that resolution is in January of 2018. So it's a very short window. And basically, if they don't get the franchise in December, then, you know, that's it for the county's share of that. The city money is a little bit more fuzzy. Jay, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that I think that the $7 million or so from the rainy day fund that stems from the sale of Blue Ash Airport land, that can go on from here. The Oakley TIF money probably as well.
Right. I mean, that's the cash part, and I would assume that clearly, I think that city leaders think that, you know, if there's not a soccer stadium at this Oakley site, there's going to be something else. So they would still need infrastructure for something else. It could be reprogrammed for that. But I'm sure that they would just rescind one ordinance and pass a new ordinance to come up with a different plan for how to fund it.
And, of course, we'll have a new council.
The other thing is that the hotel tax money that we were talking about earlier as a source for the city's contribution to this, that's still subject to approval from one more body called the Convention Facilities Authority.
And they met today and decided not to take action today because they said there were too many unknowns.
They were not going to – I don't think they were going to vote today, but anyway, but they'll need their permission to do this.
Go ahead. There was one thing that on the Oakley piece, the original plan – I think there was at least three TIFs.
There were three, now there's two.
Right, and one of those was, there was one that was centered on Madison Road.
On the Oakley Square Business District,
and
basically.
That TIF was originally included in the funding for the stadium, for the infrastructure. It was taken out on Monday after the Oakley Community Council had voted to, they didn't want their TIF rated. And so they pulled that back out, and then that was about $2.5 million. That $2.5 million would be made up from the city's capital budget, which would be approved at the end of June.
So I think it's important to note it, to talk about, this has happened at a very quick pace.
And can you hold that thought, Sherry? Because we've got some callers who want to ask that very same question. We will continue our conversation. You can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU, and joining us to discuss the FC Cincinnati Stadium plan and what happens next are Cincinnati Inquirer investigative reporter Sharon Coolidge, Inquirer Xavier Basketball and FC Cincinnati reporter Patrick Brennan, Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterick, and WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman. You can join us 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And let's talk to Jason right now. Jason, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I had a question for you. I wanted to propose a possible location I haven't heard publicly. My thought was, what about the Hamilton County Fairgrounds? The fairgrounds is approximately 18 and a half acres. It would be large enough to house parking, substantial parking. And it would prop up the areas around the stadium, which are kind of in dire need, being Hartwell, Elmwood Place, Carthage. It's close. You know, it's right off 75. You have three ways in and out. You have Galbraith, Vine, and 75. It's close to Norwood Lateral. It is central to the northern part of the community, being Butler County. It's close enough to UC. It's close enough to downtown. And people that live in northern Kentucky. Hamilton County Fairgrounds are used once a year, twice a year, tops. I wanted to know what your thoughts are about that.
Okay, Jason. Yeah.
You know, that's a really interesting idea. And I know that, for example, former Mayor Mark Mallory had looked near the end of his term or sometime during his term at redeveloping that area. I don't recall the ins and outs of why that didn't happen, but I know that he at one point had looked at that. I don't know what the current administration would think about that or the team, but certainly a fascinating idea.
Yeah, it's a great thought. What I would say is that, one, it's a little bit late in the game, I think, to divert attention away from the three sites that FC Cincinnati has been looking at all along. In theory, a great suggestion, but MLS also has a few stipulations about where their stadiums are built. And there's not just a requirement to have a soccer-specific stadium. It has to be built in the urban core. Now, that's kind of a nebulous phrase, but people have taken that to mean, and FC Cincinnati took it to mean, that they would look for a stadium in order to satisfy that requirement. They would look in the Ohio River Basin, kind of where the river used to be, you know, down over the Rhine south into northern Kentucky. So I don't think the fairgrounds would qualify for urban core for MLS purposes. But Nashville, I understand, is also building their stadium some distance away from their downtown area as well. So
at their state fairgrounds.
That's right.
Actually.
That's right.
Yeah.
I like this because I get to ask questions instead of have to answer them. But do we have a sense? I think the timeline was that if FC Cincinnati were accepted into MLS, that they would be playing in this new stadium in 2020. Do we have a drop dead on when construction would actually have to physically start on a site to meet that goal?
That's a great question.
Because there's some nebulous that, and Chris can get into this, Sherry, too, that – you know, there's still the possibility. Yeah, Oakley is the site on paper now, but there's still plenty of speculation going around.
Yeah.
That it could still end up in the West End. Well, if they were to make a change, you know, how long, essentially they would have 2 years, how long do they have to get that worked out before they have to put shovels in the ground and start building the stadium?
Chris, you mentioned the ticking clock on the money the county has set aside. So, I mean, I would think that's probably going to be a good piece of encouragement to jumpstart construction.
So, and I don't have as much contact with the team as Patrick does, nor our reporter who does most of FC Cincinnati stuff, Steve Watkins. But Steve has relayed to me that he's of the belief, and maybe the team is as well, that, you know, that continuing to play in Nippert while the stadium's thing is worked out might be fine with the league as long as the stadium plan was set and ready to go. Or they had, you know, the wherewithal to get one done.
Would Hamilton County's parking garage even be needed if it were built in the West End?
I think it would. Um, I don't know that it's going to be Hamilton County's parking garage, but I think they need a parking garage. And there are several sites in close proximity to the Weston site, which is potentially behind Taft High School, the Cincinnati Public Schools football stadium. They also play soccer there. And so, you know, there's land next to that site where you could potentially have parking, and then you could also redevelop the place that we're sitting right now, which is the town center garage across from Music Hall and the building that we're sitting in. So,
but that's what I was curious, if you had something like that, if 3CDC were to redevelop this block that we're sitting in right now, and then that frees up, well, there's your parking garage, and then perhaps the county's money could flow to something else.
If Jack Casino took bets on who the developer would be of that parking garage, I would put all of my money on 3CDC.
Let's talk to Jim. Hi, Jim.
This is Jim from Oakley.
Hi, Jim.
Go right ahead, Jim.
Mr. Birding testified at City Council on Monday that this process started back in January of this year. And my question is, why did FC Cincinnati wait to come to the Oakley Community Council or the city and make it public the day of the election? I mean, what was going on before all that? And obviously the mayor and other members of council knew about it, but it was held back from the public until after the election, which it might have changed the election had they come out and talked about it beforehand.
Jim, you just made every point I would have made about that. I think that we didn't get, you know, there was discussions and we kind of knew that the stadium discussion would need to happen. But I don't know that we necessarily knew there was this fairly solid plan that they unveiled the days after the election. And I suspect that if it had been revealed before the election, we would have seen a lot more discussion both in the mayor's race and the council's race about the plan and the merits of it. And, you know, they certainly, you know, were able to avoid that by the way they unveiled this.
And I'm still trying to work out some facts on this. The mayor told the Inquirer yesterday that he was under the impression all year that the funding was fine and that all of the residual hotel tax, the county's portion and the city's portion, would be used. That was plenty and everything was good to go. And he said he found out at the last minute that the county was not going to be putting in any of their hotel tax money. And, you know, that is not the story I got from the Board of Commissioners President Todd Portune, who told me he was asked at the last minute for the county portion of the hotel tax, to which the commissioners then had an executive session. And we're talking like 2 weeks ago.
Right.
They had an executive session where it was discussed and they decided against that idea. And so I'm having two very conflicting stories about, things that happened in the background about funding. And I will point out, too, that there were discussions that we know about, and our public officials were asked to sign non-disclosure forms when these things were discussed, and some of them did do that.
I kind of wondered, and I don't know that we'll ever know really the answer to Jim's question, but I kind of wonder whether these are some of the most powerful people in the city. Carl Linder III, Scott Farmer, these are the co-owners of FC Cincinnati. And I just wonder whether they thought our elected officials would kind of capitulate, you know, roll over and do what was requested of them. And when that didn't happen, you kind of saw this mad scramble at the very, you know, end of this process.
Patrick?
You know, I thought it was incredible that, there's a working assumption among some members of the media that the conversation was delayed until later because they didn't want to inject it into the election season. And it just that we got to the last minute and had a contentious, at times ugly conversation about getting this across the finish line it just struck me as incredible, because throughout the summer, FC Cincinnati had quite rightfully earned a lot of goodwill, maybe all the goodwill they would have needed to get something done earlier. There were so many highs this past summer in particular, the U.S. Open Cup run, some of those home matches they played in the U.S. Open Cup,
they weren't
soccer matches. They were civic celebrations.
Right.
And I wonder, the June unveiling of the stadium design itself was an incredibly momentous occasion. And I wonder if that might have been a great opportunity to roll this thing out. So I get the train of thought about not wanting to inject this into the election season, but man, they had all the goodwill in the world going for
them. So you're saying it's missed opportunities
then. I think so, yeah.
They could have had a slogan, Mitch says yes, Mitch says no, and the region says yes, you know, or something like that.
Well, the council members who voted against the financing deal, even they said, we're not against soccer. We just have questions. And so they wanted to make that point clear with their no votes. And of course, they had a majority in the end. It was a 5-3 vote. And so, but they were like, we just have a lot of questions and we don't have them answered yet. And so it's hard to fault people for asking questions. We still have questions.
Yeah. Oh, there's a ton of questions. But one thing I want to point out, though, is that even prior to the election, when this was discussed at the county commission, Todd Portune would say over and over again, and actually I think the other commissioners as well, they would say, well, you know, they're asking us for stuff, kind of, but we don't know quite what. And we've said, well, we want to talk to the city, but the city has told us there will be nothing done before the election. And that to me was a clue.
They did say that.
You know, that was calculated, that was how it was planned.
Let's talk to Charles. Hi, Charles.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Listen, I did a Googling on scheduling of soccer games. A lot of them are during the week and they're during rush hour. And you've got Madison Road, which is hellacious during rush hour. You've got Red Bank Road, which is hellacious during rush hour. And so is the Ridge exit. And then there's a side question that goes to that. Will the revenues actually benefit the smaller businesses in Oakley or just those in the surrounding near that shopping center?
I don't think I quite heard the end of it, whether the revenues will benefit.
Well, you've got big chains that are going to be near the stadium. Will they benefit more than, say, the smaller shops down in Oakley Square?
That's hard to tell, and I think what you've pointed out there is a reason why the Oakley site is so problematic. It is not in the urban core, at least as I would define it. It is out in kind of the big box store area of Oakley, which is completely different from, you know, kind of the easily walkable business district area that I think many people like about Oakley and why Oakley is such a hot neighborhood. They're putting the stadium out with the, you know, where Target and Sam's Club and whatnot is. And it's not the easiest place to access or figure out how to get around in. And I think that's why the traffic issues as well are problematic. As for, you know, which businesses will benefit, at least the way that they have it set up now is I don't see that the businesses on Oakley Square will benefit to a great degree. Now, I will say that and point out that the folks who are hardcore supporters of FC Cincinnati say, yes, we are going to, you know, we're going to go patronize businesses at Oakley Square, and then we're going to walk through the big box land to the stadium. And, you know, fair enough, more power to them if that's the case. But the way that thing is designed doesn't really, you know, allow for a lot of that to occur, I don't think.
And Chris, can you get even more specific about where they're thinking about putting this in Oakley?
Yeah, it's called the Cast Fab site. It's a former industrial site. It's currently under demolition. And so if you think about how Oakley Station is laid out, it's kind of, you know, right to the left, I suppose, if you're facing the Cinemark Theater, if you're standing in front of it, is roughly where it would go. And, you know, they'll need to extend some roads around it as well.
Do we have any idea how long they've been looking at the Oakley site? I guess I was struck when they were talking about this at the council meeting that they hadn't done the traffic study yet.
Right.
And it would assume that the second you think, okay, we're going to go to Oakley, can we get people in and out of there? Why didn't they just, even if the team had to pay for it, why not do a traffic study on each of the
sites? Many times did the city engineer have to say on Monday when council members were asking questions, I don't know, we have to do a traffic study. I don't know, we have to do a traffic study. I don't know.
That was just a great bit of bureaucratic blocking for them. Because, I mean, we know, for example, that Madison Road, you know, north of Ridge, northeast of Ridge, is going to have to be widened under this plan. And there are about 24 homes that sit there. And they're not, you know, it's not a real big space. So either they're going to take a lot of people's yards or they're going to demolish homes. And the city engineer sat there and pretended like he didn't know what was going to happen there. And that was just one example of the many, many unanswered questions about this that council members and the media had. And yet the mayor and the majority of council pushed it through anyway.
And a couple of other stories I want to touch on before we wrap up this segment. And Chris, speaking of infrastructure, the county has a plan for paying to replace the Western Hills Viaduct. So what's in that?
They have kind of part of a plan. They don't have a.
They're going to play the Powerball.
right.
Don't we all?
Well, in all fairness to them, you know, they passed a $5 fee on license plates in the county, and so everybody who has vehicles, you'll have to do it for all your vehicles, will have to pay this fee, and they are going to use half of it, I believe, to put the county match for the money for Western Hills Viaduct. We're talking about, you know, $33.5 million roughly. The other half will be used on other city or other county roads and bridges. And this will be a 30-year fee. It will sunset after 30 years, which was really important to the Republican member of commission, Chris Monzel. This was another unanimous bipartisan vote at the county, which we've kind of seen a lot of, which has been impressive to me at least.
So I think something that got lost in the election is like a lot of people were asking the mayor and Yvette, what about the Western Hills Viaduct? In the meantime, the county was sitting over there, and they actually were coming up with a plan. I mean, Todd Bertoon is the person. He's on something, the Transportation Improvement District, and it's been talked about there for years. Todd actually rolled out this plan where he talked about, you know, if we could come up with our portion of the money and the city can, then we're in a good position to ask the state and feds for the rest. It's like 80-20. But they really... There's a real plan developing, and I actually feel like this is actually going to happen for the first time in a long time that we've been talking about this.
Yeah, I mean, there's no guarantee we'll get the state and federal money, but this is helpful. This is, you know, this gives you, you know, what you needed to at least go make the case.
And Sharon, the city's wrapped up its investigation into City Manager Harry Black's late night call to FOP President Dan Hills, yes. where Dan claims that that Black threatened him during this call. And what did the investigation conclude?
You know, in the end, it concluded there was no wrongdoing found all around. I think that's the number one thing, like out of everything that we have finally heard. There was this call, the FOP president, he made a police report and he filed a grievance. And so the outcomes of both of those were no wrongdoing. For the police report, you know, it went all the way to Joe Dieters. He's like, no, there's nothing here. And then we did hear this week that the grievance, they did an investigation. And, you know, they came to the conclusion that there was really no threat made. And their finding was the city manager should probably limit his calls to work hours. And so that's
other than
like,
that, no harassment, no threat involved.
Yes. And, you know, Dan Hills really, you know, his comment was an apology would be nice. But, you know, I don't think one's forthcoming.
Is this the end of this dispute? Is this the end of this?
Yes, I believe it is. Dan said that he's not going to pursue it more. And I think we've heard the last of it.
But I would not expect that there will be any thawing of relations between the city administration and the FOP.
No.
There's a long list of things that would need to be defrosted.
Which is really interesting, though, when you think about it, because the mayor is so close to the FOP and the city manager is not.
Well, Sharon, Patrick, Jay, and Chris, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cincinnati Inquirer investigative reporter Sharon Coolidge, Inquirer Xavier Basketball and FC Cincinnati reporter Patrick Brennan, Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wederick, and WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman. Coming up, former GOP rivals for Ohio governor team up as running mates, and Ohio grants medical marijuana licenses to a dozen companies. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. What happens when you report sexual harassment to the Human Resources Department? Monday on Cincinnati Edition, HR experts join us, and we want to hear from you. If you filed a complaint, did the harassment stop? Email talk@wvxu.org or call us at 513-419-7113 to leave a recorded message before the show. Ohio Attorney General Mike DeWine and Secretary of State John Husted were likely to be formidable opponents in May's GOP primary for Ohio governor. Now they've teamed up as running mates, with DeWine leading the ticket and Husted running as his lieutenant governor. And joining us with an update on the governor's race and a look at other top Ohio stories of the week, Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau reporter Joe Ingles. And good afternoon, Joe. Thank you for being here.
Good afternoon. It's great to be here.
So how did this pairing come about, and did this surprise you that this happened?
Well, apparently it came about over some really great muffins because I guess the way it was told at the news conference is that DeWine had invited Husted down to his house in the morning, and Fran DeWine had made some muffins, and they had a talk, and they just decided that this was the way to go rather than fighting it out in a primary and having things that might be said in that primary be held against whoever won it. They felt like they were the strongest, and financially they certainly are because they have about $9 million now in their campaign war chest, which is way more than the other candidates have.
So it's fair to say, Joe, that this was the top one and two in the governor's race on the GOP side?
Yeah, I think that was widely believed to be the case. And I've been told by people who had seen some polling, and we're not privy to that because it was private polling, but I'm told that that was the case, that they were the two top vote getters. And they were, you know, honestly, if you looked at like who was supporting them and coming out endorsing them across the state of Ohio, they were getting a lot of endorsements from big time Republicans and Republican groups.
So what does DeWine bring to the table? What does Husted bring to the table in this particular campaign relationship?
Well, DeWine has vast name recognition. He's been in politics for a very long time. He's well known, and he has a lot of experience. And he's been elected on the statewide level several times. And so he brings that to the table. Husted also has some name recognition, maybe not quite as much, but he also has a pretty good resume as far as being Secretary of State and the former Speaker of the Ohio House. He's been a legislator. He's got some talents there. Now, you know, there is a big age difference here because DeWine is, I think, Husted. Their ages, I can't remember, but Husted's in his 40s, and DeWine is hitting 70, somewhere around there. So you're talking a little bit of an age difference there. But together, they say that they're going to tackle the big issues, opioids, jobs, education, those sorts of things. And they both bring a strong resume to the table.
Now, how are the other GOP candidates reacting to this?
Well, Mary Taylor held a news conference to announce that she's still in the race. And she said to her, this is just like John Husted dropping out of the race. That's the way she put it. She said that it's, you know, they're just insiders and she's the one who has the plan. Of course, you know, Jim Renacci, congressman, he's standing out there saying, wait, I'm an outsider, too. I'm not one of those insiders. And, you know, I've been backed. I've been backing President Trump. And I'm, you know, I'm the conservative here. And so I'm the choice.
Now,
so they're staying in.
Meantime, Richard Cordray on the Democratic side, he just left his job as the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And I guess at this point, we're just waiting to hear if he's going to join the race on the Democratic side.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We're waiting to hear what he's going to do. The stream of thought is that he will be announcing in the next couple of weeks, probably sooner rather than later. You know, all the candidates on that side are kind of waiting to see what happens there, too.
Is there a point, Joe, at which Cordray could be too late getting into the race?
Yes, February 8th.
Okay.
February 7th.
That's the filing deadline, isn't it?
Yeah. That's the filing deadline is February 7th. But there's no indication that he's going to wait that long. Now that he's not at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, he can file and be able to run. And, you know, one thing to remember is that Cordray will be able to raise money quickly. That's something the other four Democratic candidates who are in the race, that's the advantage they don't have, is being able to do that. But with Cordray, with his Washington connections, with the backing of Senator Liz Warren, she, you know, those kind of affiliations and all the backing there, he can go out and raise money rather quickly. So he's not pressed for time, but he will probably do it soon.
Now, I understand there's been a new development in the medical marijuana licensing and that particular program in Ohio. What's the latest with this, Joe?
Well, they came out with the 12 large cultivator licenses. These are the large grow operations, and they came out naming the companies, the 12 companies that would get those operations. And one of the companies that wanted to get that operation had backed the failed ballot issue in Ohio to bring medical marijuana back in 2015. Those backers are now saying that the system for awarding these licenses is flawed, that the people who got the licenses were given those licenses, at least some of them, for political favoritism, and that they better met the criteria than some of the people who were awarded licenses. And so they're threatening a lawsuit and actually even hinting that they're not opposed to bringing back another medical marijuana measure on the ballot in the future if this doesn't get settled correctly.
So what was the selection process? How exactly did that work?
Well, there was a scoring process, and they looked at a lot of different things when they were scoring them. They looked at, you know, financials. Do they have the money to do this? They looked at issues about the delivery. Would they be able to deliver on what they say they're going to be able to deliver? They look at criminal background checks. They look at funding, and they look at racial classifications, a lot of different things. And the criteria they went through and they scored it. And the 12 highest scores got the cultivator's licenses. Now, these are, you know, the big grow operations, and the people who got those stand to make a lot of money under the state's program, which is supposed to be implementable. Is that a word? Supposed to be implemented.
Sounds good to me. It'll work for a Friday afternoon.
For a Friday. But the program's supposed to be implemented starting next September.
Well, how many companies originally applied for this?
There were about 109 that applied for this license. Then there was another sort of license for cultivators, smaller cultivators. And there were almost 177 applications was the total, I think, for both of those licenses. But there were 109 for the smaller license. And they got the, I think it was 109. But they got the 12 out of that. So they had to do a lot of scoring there.
So pending this lawsuit, we've got these 12 organizations that have been selected geographically. Where are they?
Well, they're all over the state, except there are none in Franklin County, which was kind of shocking because you would think that maybe with Ohio State being here and having some major research institutions
and
that
the state
we would
capital
also have.
And
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there are none here or even are in the contiguous counties, but there seven of them are up in northern, northeast Ohio area. And you're getting some down in your area in southwest Ohio. There will be one around the Wilmington area. There's one around Springfield. They're kind of all over the place down there. There's some near Cincinnati. And so you're going to have four or five of them down there.
And I understand, too, the Senate's passed a bill to legalize online gaming in Ohio. So quickly tell us about what that's about.
Well, it will put basically it puts the gaming under the control of the commission that controls other gambling right now. And it would the idea is that there's someone that needs to control it. It would prevent an operator from offering these fantasy contests to youth or college sports because, of course, the NCAA is very adamant about, you know, that kind of thing. And it also, there was also a part of it, some of the Republicans have been fighting to include this, and this is something to watch. There's a debate over whether a tax should be included in that gaming to help fund the fantasy gaming addictions or something like that. So we'll see how this goes when it goes through the House.
Joe, thank you for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Joe Ingles. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. You can find archives of our programs at WVXU.org. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer was Selena Reeder. Josh Elstro was the technical director. I'm Mark Haney.